simply by changing the shape of the nose cone on the front of this supersonic train to mimic that of the shape of a kingfisher beak. The intention actually resulted in eliminating this sonic boom phenomena that was happening as the train went through tunnels. But they subsequently also saw a 3% improvement in energy efficiency.
I'm your host, Adam Mett, and today we're chatting about something really interesting called biomimicry with Dr. Dana Baumeister. The conversation today at its core is about nature and the incredible tools that it provides to help solve some of the biggest problems in the world today. A quick reminder that we're planting a tree for every person who subscribes to this podcast, so make sure to hit that subscribe button. And without further ado, here is Dr. Dana Baumeister on Planet Reimagined. Biomimicry, it's such a diverse field. To start off, can you give us an idea first of what it is and all the different topics that it encompasses?
So when we look at biomimicry, there's two things that are probably most important to understand about it. First is that it is an emerging discipline, but it's an emerging discipline of an ancient practice, which is ultimately about looking to nature for answers, right? How do we live in this world? And as a species, we've been wandering the plains of Africa and then subsequently other parts of the planet for about 300,000 years. And in that time, we've always asked our fellow beings, what does it mean to live here now? And that's much of what traditional ecological knowledge stems from. But in our 21st century, as we're looking about formalizing this as a practice, the emergence of biomimicry has become more of a discipline, you know, a place where you can go and you can study, where there's, you know, academic papers written on it, where you can understand the practice and much more, say, mindfully and intentionally with a discipline to it, begin to work on it. And our definition for biomimicry is the conscious emulation of nature's genius. And we actually chose those four words pretty carefully. Conscious implies intent. It's not just like, oh, I happen to look and act like nature, but you're actually mindfully recognizing that maybe some other species might have a few things figured out that we haven't. So consciously going out, but emulating is also really important because it's about really taking the design lens, the design principle of how nature's doing it and applying it. We're never going to fly our helicopters like honeybees, like the laws of physics simply won't allow. But can we learn what those design practices and principles are that work so well and then subsequently apply them to our emulations? And they may be tangible things. And so it may very well be product design. It could be buildings. It could be cities. But it could also be the intangible, how we communicate, how we share information long distance, how we conduct transactions of value and worth, how we cooperate, right? All of those things are also relevant to ask the natural world. And then nature's genius is based on the premise, well, you know, we've been around for 300,000 years, which may sound like a lot, but it's really a blink in the eye of life, which is around for 3.8 billion years. And we're only one of at least 30 million, maybe upwards of 100 million species that are living on the planet today. So there's clearly probably some genius in that. Nobody looks to nature and says, oh, she has no idea what she's doing. Like, she's so yesterday, you know, like, I mean, it's very clear that there's some genius. So that's the definition of biomimicry. And it's being applied in many, many different places around the world. We actually have three critical legs of the stool for biomimicry, and it actually what differentiates it between things like bio-inspired design or biomimetics, which are missing some of these legs. So all of those have in common some sort of nature inspiration for design, which is, you know, borrow an idea and apply it to sure. the human space. But the two critical legs that we believe are equally important to the practice of improving our designs, one is what we call the ethos. So it's like, what are we actually applying those lessons to? And how are we going about doing it? So You know, are we applying it to build a better nuclear warhead? Thinking life's going to be so keen on that use of their ideas. And likewise, we may apply it in to, say, solve a sustainable challenge around, say, cleaning surfaces. But if we use toxic chemicals to mimic the way nature, like a lotus leaf, cleans surfaces, have we really gained anything? So the ethos really drives us to think about this from a sustainability perspective. What's worth solving and how do we go about solving it? But then the other leg that's really important is also what we call the reconnect. You might think of it as the connect leg for people that have never connected with nature, or the reconnect leg that reminds us that we are indeed connected with nature. And this is the one that's really about actually going out and observing, about spending time in nature, about recognizing the interconnectedness and interdependence of everything, recognizing that we are nature, we are just one of the species. And so it comes with a big slice of humble pie and sort of putting ourselves in our rightful place of recognizing where we sit. So we bring all three of those elements to the work that we do, and we believe they're critically important.
That's incredible. I want to dive deeper into a few of the things that you just talked about. The first being technology. And I see technology as kind of our climate original sin, but it also can provide a lot of solutions. In your world of biomimicry, do you also see technology as this double-edged sword? And you started to get into it a little bit, but I'd love to hear more about it.
Yeah, I mean, it's definitely a double-edged sword. I mean, it's created a good chunk of the issues that we have today, but it isn't so much the technology that's created those issues, but it was the underlying framework and foundational mindset behind the technology that ultimately created the issues. And so I believe, you know, sort of a path forward is a joint effort between leveraging technology, because we can't strip that from our world today. And in fact, I would argue that even organisms use forms of technology, but it must be coupled with a mindset and a philosophy that leverages not just how we use the technology, but again, how we develop it and what our mindset is around it. I mean, of course, in the United States, the precautionary principle is sort of this abstract thing that only academics know of. But in Europe and some other more progressive thinking places, it's kind of part of the national zeitgeist of like really thinking about, do we want to do this and why? And, you know, should we approach this in that sort of precautionary way? And I think that's one of the many kinds of mindsets that is important for how technology can help us. I think to ride a technology bandwagon where we think that's the answer to everything is really sort of an ignorant stance to take.
Sure.
Because it's not going to solve it alone, right? Like, I think the pandemic is a great example of that in terms of just looking at our wide variety of diversity of our own personal responses to this, how we feel about it, how we're addressing it, and how we can't even adopt the simplest of all technologies, which is a cloth mask, right? And so recognizing that we have to work with these two things hand in hand, I think will be really important for determining whether or not we get to stay on the planet. We are on the extinction list, and we've got to recognize that we are. And then, you know, how are we going to go about going forward if that's the case?
Absolutely. It's interesting. On this podcast a lot, we talk about the connections between systems. We talk about how education is related to poverty, is related to gender equality, and how everything is related to climate. And biomimicry seems to live at the center of this idea of intersectionality. Can you talk a little bit about whether it's an interdisciplinary approach or this idea of intersectionality and how it relates to you and your work?
Yeah, I mean, first of all, I'm trained as a Dana Meadows systems thinker. So I'm a Dana Meadows fellow. So but I'm also an ecologist. So an ecologist can't be anything but a systems thinker. And so I'm naturally always looking for those connections. And biomimicry is inherently transdisciplinary. If you are doing biomimicry alone, you're not doing biomimicry. Like, there's no way that you can know the biology, know the engineering, know the design, know the business, know the strategy, know the communications in order to be successful. So I created and built the world's first master's in biomimicry. And we started it in 2008. We became accredited in 2013. And we have we're up to like 450 students now that have gone or going through the program. And just looking at the sampling of the students, right, of what their professional background is a testament to how transdisciplinary it is, right? So, of course, we have biologists. Of course, we have engineers. Of course, we have designers. But we also have, you know, sustainability strategists and communicators. I have lawyers. I have doctors. I've yet to come across a problem or a question in which nature didn't have something to offer. I mean, sometimes the answer is, well, no, none of the other 30 million species are doing that. So maybe you might want to question your assumptions that that's an okay thing to do. But really, there's always some insights. And so therefore, both the solution, but the process of getting to the solution ultimately live in this interconnected world.
Amazing. CO2, one of the largest contributors to the climate crisis. Are there any examples in the biomimicry world that help to address the CO2 problem?
Yeah, so of course it's not just CO2, but it's methane and, you know, all the other, you know, gases that are contributors, methane and CO2 being the biggest ones. Biomimicry has a lot to offer on many fronts, right? So at some level, we have to ask the question, why are we emitting so much CO2 in the first place? And some of it has to do with just overall energy efficiency. And there's oodles of examples of how nature might improve or help us improve our processes. You take what was formerly known as the bullet train in Japan, now is called the Shinkansen. And simply by changing the shape of the nose cone on the front of this supersonic train to mimic that of the shape of a kingfisher beak, the intention actually resulted in eliminating this sonic boom phenomenon that was happening as the train went through tunnels. But they subsequently also saw a 3% improvement in energy efficiency. And it's important to know in engineering, especially when it comes to energy efficiency, if you can get anything better than 2%, that's like, ooh, you know, everybody gets excited, you know. And there's other examples in energy, like there's some mimicry of the internal shapes of seashells that have sort of a Fibonacci spiral. Turns out to be an excellent way to move water. And so PAX fans and PAX water have developed a number of units of propellers and impellers and fan blades that mimic that Fibonacci spiral. And they're seeing like 15, 16, 18% improvements in energy efficiency. In fact, so great that people don't believe them. And so they actually have to bring them to the lab and have them see the data generated in real time. So the engineers will believe that this could improve. And of course, that makes sense, right? A shell has to move fluids, and why wouldn't it choose a form that creates the least amount of drag possible? And so there's lots of things that are about how much energy we consume, you know, in terms of moving fluids, moving objects. But then there's also all the energy that we consume around lighting, around heating. And so, I mean, the plethora of ways to think about energy or temperature management in buildings. We just actually had a project with a Canadian-based clothing company that was asking about, you know, better ways to insulate our bodies, you know, learning from nature. And so all of those, if you sort of systematically applied them everywhere, right? So then we see a huge reduction in the amount of carbon produced. The second piece of the equation is, how do we stop so much from going up in the atmosphere? So we've already produced it. And how do we grab it at the smokestack? And there's some really interesting work around learning from how nature sequesters carbon dioxide. Photosynthesis, right, is the process of grabbing CO2 in the presence of sunlight, add some water, convert it to a long chain hydrocarbon, right? And plastics are essentially long chain hydrocarbons. So by mimicking photosynthesis and photosynthetic processes, we can convert CO2 to plastic. Now, it's the amount of CO2 that we're putting out and the amount of plastic we need, there's still a huge gap, right? Like that's not going to solve it. But things like polycarbonates and whatnot can be made from CO2 that's going up into the atmosphere. The other thing that life uses CO2 for is to make calcium bicarbonate, which is also known as chalk. And chalk, when used in biological systems, is what nature builds shells with. And the reason why shells are so much harder than chalk is it's a brick-laying process of chalk and protein, chalk and protein, chalk and protein. And that layering process creates these ultra-strong shells. And so there's also folks that are looking at substitutes for cement, which, right, when we carve limestone out of a rock, we're using it to make Portland cement. And limestone are old shell bodies, right, that have compressed over geological time. So why not then just use the process of shell formation, which is called biomineralization, as a way to, you know, get rid of Portland cement altogether, and then actually ultimately fix more carbon as a result. So there's several different cement companies that are grabbing CO2 from smokestacks and using it to create concrete. So that's a couple of ideas that are in that space of grab it before it goes out the smokestack. But then the third piece of the puzzle is bringing carbon home, right? All that carbon that we've sent out, can we not bring it back down? And of course, the very best place to put carbon is in biomass. And at that level, biomimicry offers opportunities to increase the rate of sequestration, right? So one could just be let wild be wild, let the forest be the forest. But there's all sorts of opportunities in agriculture and aquaculture that can allow us to mimic the way a forest works and still get our food crops out of that, right? So perennial and regenerative agriculture actually ends up sequestering more carbon per unit of biomass than traditional forms of, or let me call industrial forms of agriculture do. And so there's a lot that one can learn from biomimicry in terms of how do we bring more carbon home and faster. So yes, the short answer is lots of ways in which CO2 and biomimicry intersect.
Would you mind going just into a bit more detail about perennial and regenerative agriculture, just for people who are listening and don't know what that is?
Yeah, of course. So, you know, conventional industrial agriculture is about tilling and plowing up a field, putting a single monocrop down, adding a lot of fertilizer, adding a lot of water, adding a lot of pesticides, adding a lot of herbicides, driving over it with a diesel guzzling tractor, and then harvesting really nutrient poor food from the landscape, right?
Yeah.
And perennial agriculture most of our food crops are annual, so we have to turn it over every year and plant new seeds and so on. But the most abundant and effective resource systems are perennials. They have a mix of crops, so they're diverse, and they're not annuals, so they get used, you know, they grow and add, you know, new seed heads or whatever each year. So if you look at a tall grass prairie, which is a great example, and the Land Institute in Kansas is doing beautiful work around this, they've actually been working to re-perennialize some of our annual crops, because what they learned is if you look at a tall grass prairie, and this is the biomimicry piece, there's sort of four main groups of plants that are in a tall grass prairie. You have warm season grasses, cool season grasses, legumes, that's our beans, and sunflower species. And the majority of our temperate crops fit in one of those four categories. So they said, what if we were to re-perennialize some of our crops like wheat, sunflower, rapeseed, of course, soybeans, all of those are the legumes, and make them perennials and then actually put them in a mixed polyculture so that we don't have to till the soil. We don't have to add as much water. We barely have to add any fertilizer or herbicides because there's diversity in the system. The only thing we have to do is get technology to develop a harvesting machine that can harvest, which is not a complicated engineering question. And so they've made great progress. Wheat has already been perennialized. It's called Kenza. And they're working towards shifting that. And then, of course, that whole thing is a carbon sink, and it produces more nutrient-rich foods. And regenerative agriculture is in that same category, but it's really about How can we be a net contributor to the ecosystem as opposed to a net depleter of the ecosystem? Can the practice of agriculture actually add soil, right? And add nutrients to the soil as opposed to deplete them? And of course, traditional and indigenous agriculture always did that, right? They wouldn't have been able to have been around if we've been farming for 10,000 years. We never would have made it 10,000 years using current techniques. So some of it is about, you know, revisiting what the small landholder is already embracing and in doing and supporting those processes.
Fantastic.
The UN came together in 2015 and wrote 17 sustainable development goals that were agreed to by 193 countries, which in and of itself is an amazing feat. But they're kind of divided into a bunch of different categories. You have economic, social, environmental, and political goals. And in the beginning, when we first started talking, you talked about examples of biomimicry that can start to affect other systems that weren't just focused on environmentalism. Can you talk about some of the systems that biomimicry can touch that might be political or economic or even social?
Yeah, definitely. So we have a whole branch of the work that we do that we call social innovation, right? So biomimicry and social innovation. And you have to be just a little more mindful in this space because you're using lessons from nature a little bit more metaphorically, which means there's more risk of misinterpreting it and using it to serve your own goals. In some ways, Hitler was a biomimic and arguing that he was selecting for certain types of people. He was his own form of natural selection, which, of course, is awful. And so we want to be really careful. Or people saying, well, of course, I'm the CEO of the company because I'm the brains of the operation and the brain runs the body. But we know the brain is not really in charge of the body. And so like there's this risk of those sorts of metaphors and how we use it. But that being said, like I'll give you an example of a project that we did a really deep dive into, which was around the question of mutualism. So mutualisms in nature were two very different kinds of organisms cooperate in a long-term relationship that spans evolutionary time. And both, you know, it's the classic win-win situation. And, you know, you definitely hear about movements in sustainability where we want everything to be a win-win, but what does that really mean and how do you accomplish it? And so what we did is we did a survey of about 160 different mutualisms in nature and then pulled out the deep patterns that they all had in common, right? So when you look at patterns, it gets us away from some of those traps or biases, or because it's like, well, if all 160 are doing it, there's probably something to that. And I can't really deny it. And in fact, I have a whole webinar that focuses just on this question on our website. And so we identified four key principles that are necessary for long-term enduring mutualistic relationships. Then those principles can then become the guidelines for how you could set up mutualistic partnerships between organizations. And of course, then, I mean, those are relevant to all sorts of SD goals, right? You know, like if you're talking about, you know, an NGO coming from the Netherlands and coming down into Chad to work on, you know, childhood poverty, and you're working with a local organization, and how do you design that in such a way that is mutualistic? And so we originally did the project for an NGO called Canopy that seeks to develop partnerships with businesses to change their feedstock from sourcing materials from virgin forest. And so think of like newspaper and magazine companies or even the fashion industry. A lot of our clothing and materials come from virgin wood. And they partner with these companies to say, hey, let's find a different source. So their whole model is based on partnerships, but they didn't really know exactly how to make sure those worked well. And so we worked with them and brought these principles in, and then they did a sort of assessment of their partnerships. And by using that biomimicry lens, it helped them really change the framing of their partnerships. So for example, you know, there's the clear win-win, but I can't assume that it's a win for you. I can't say I'm really good for you and this is why, right? You have to tell me why I'm a benefit. And in fact, your contribution back to me has to come really easy to you. That's like one of the rules. Like you have to be doing it already. And just like my offering to you has to be something I have to be doing already. It can't come at a cost because then it's like, ugh, what a drag. So when they did those assessments, suddenly their sort of struggling partnerships became much more robust because they asked those different questions. So yes, those are some of the ways in which just the question of mutualisms can inform some of these processes.
I'm curious because you've come across so many different projects in the field. What is an example of one of the more outlandish projects that you've come across or one of your favorites?
Yeah, I hate superlative questions because it's much more intriguing to think about for a particular context, like what's the most powerful and has the most potential to, you know, to bring about change. And anytime I say one, then I go, oh, shoot, I forgot to mention that one because that one's really interesting. And there's so many diverse examples. And each one has its own brilliance and its own right, you know, for where it is and what it can do. Even like there's a mask called the BioFriend mask that was developed actually in response to SARS that mimics the way the body deals with viruses. But it, you know, it comes out of Japan and I think they're still active, but they really should be the mask that we're using everywhere, right? And so that's a cool example that talks about right now in this context. And so we can learn from viruses and little tiny things. And then of course we can learn from like whole ecosystem phenomena to rethink about how we, you know, how we build our cities. There's too many really fun ones to think
about. Why aren't more companies doing this?
Well, I think there's a couple of factors. You know, the world runs on feedback loops, whether we like it or not. And unfortunately, some of those feedback loops are really delayed and they're really long, and then therefore they're false information. So we have a series of very quick and short-term feedback loops that reward certain behaviors that in the long term are much more consequential. And so a lot of companies have these short-term feedback loops like, well, our sales aren't plummeting. People are still buying our shit. Why should we do anything any differently? And those kinds of signals become really hard to override. What's super interesting with COVID is there's an entirely new set of signals that are coming. And new questions around resilience. Like the resilience is sort of like, yeah, we need to be resilient. And now suddenly it's like, oh, we really need to be resilient. Now I understand why resilience is important. And so we are getting more interest now, even though I would have expected with a shrinking economy that that wouldn't have happened. And I believe it's because we're seeing some of these feedback signals that are saying your way of doing things is no longer valid. The other thing is, and it's related to feedback loops. I mean, a lot of these companies, they're big systems, right? And there's a lot of people, a lot of players, and we have a lot of Fortune 500 as clients. And when you have the right people in mind and they're working with it and they're on board, that's great. But if the rest of the system doesn't help support that general adoption, and then it becomes really hard. Like we get hired to help bring in innovation, which we definitely can do. And we've got lots of great strategies to help promote creativity and innovation in companies. But if there's other feedback systems within the company that are counter to what it needs to be innovative, then you're just up against a wall. Like if the budgeting system has no tolerance for risk, even if culturally they're saying, hey, take risks, go out and be creative. But if you fail, then all your money disappears for next year. Right. Then how do you do that? So there's a lot of those, and people are not trained in systems thinking to see how all of these pieces are interconnected. And I think it's probably one of the biggest challenges we face as a society is our lack of ability to think in systems and to recognize the interconnectedness of everything. And you can see it in the leadership response to COVID, like really exceptional leaders whether it's the superintendent of a school district or the president of a university or a mayor or whatever, if they're good systems thinkers, they're really balancing all of the needs. They're looking at the impact of kids staying home and the impact of kids going to school and the impact on the nurses and the impact on the economics. And they're really trying to find a systemic kind of response. But the reaction from, you know, different people, they only see it from their little perspective. You know, how am I going to take care of my kids and who am I going to do my job? You know, and they can't hold that space for all of these different needs. And I mean, I hate to say it, but this is just the first of probably many kinds of tragedies that will face humanity in the coming decades. And this is a little dry run with not, I mean, yes, the outcomes right now are tragic, but they pale in comparison to what's ahead. And if we can't learn the processes by which we deal with disasters and tragedies through this one, the next one's going to come along and give us another try, and we'll see how well we fare with that one. But that systems perspective, and that's where nature has the upper hand on humanity, in that over evolutionary time, those feedback loops have weeded out the shitty behavior, right? Have weeded out the things that are going to get us in trouble. And, you know, those species no longer do those things because they're not around anymore, right? Or those individuals have been weeded out of the population. And being so young, and really, if you think about it, the vast majority of our activities kind of tied to the Industrial Revolution, like the last 250 years, which is just a blink. We're talking about, what, like five generations of people, which is nothing. It's not even enough time for evolution to catch up.
So you have a ton of experience in systems thinking, and you straddle this world from academia to the private sector. Would you ever consider running for political office?
No, not a chance. Not a chance. Yeah, and I think part of it is because our political system, it is by default must deal with systems thinking, but is not designed to accommodate and to embrace systems thinking, right? So the feedback loops that are tied into politics are completely disconnected from the systems in which they must serve. And that would just drive me bonkers. Like I just, there's no way. It would just be frustrating to no end. I mean, I believe I could help generate possibilities and solutions and all of that, but the feedback loops and the system would make, that are designed in the way our political system works, would just be so short-sighted and make it very difficult to actually succeed in.
Fair enough. I think only one guest out of 10 so far has actually said yes, they would be interested in running for political office.
Well, that was probably Andrew Yang, right? You just had him.
You got it. Yep. I want to talk a little bit about the future of biomimicry. So you described what it is as a field. Where do you see the field moving toward in the next few years?
Yeah, well, I see a couple of different avenues. I mean, we've been on this continuous upward trajectory of, you know, more examples, more practitioners, more stories, more application spaces and all that. And I don't see that changing at all. And what I hope to see, and this is really my intention, I did a systems diagram about 15 years ago. And, you know, my ultimate goal was to see humanity behave much more like we are a welcome species on the planet. And so when I back cast, well, how do we get that behavior? Well, we need more examples. Well, how do we get more examples? Well, we have more people executing on those examples. Well, how do we get more people? Well, we need more people who are trained. Well, how do we get more people? Well, I'll just create a training program, right? Like, so that's how it back cast. And that's ultimately what morphed into this master's degree. And what I hope to empower the participants, and what's really cool is very few of them are actually fresh out of college. Most of them are late 20s, 30s, 40s. I even have some 60-year-olds in the program. And wow. And they're all saying, I want to do something different. I want to take what I have. I've got this engineering background, or I've got this whatever, and I want to make biomimicry the tool that I use in this space. So it's a very diverse group. 30% already have graduate degrees. 30% come from other places in the world than the United States. And so they learn as much from each other as they learn in the program. Well, they've all invested a couple of years of their life and their time and their money and their intellect. They're going to go out and make things happen, right, in their space. And this is the really cool thing to begin watching. And of course, I'm watching and sure. with delight on where and how everybody is applying this work in the world. And so I think, you know, in that sort of, just like a virus, right, like you plant a few seeds and then they spread and they spread and they spread, that their stories and their impacts will spread, and we'll shift that needle a little bit closer in alignment with how nature works.
We get so many questions from young people, probably people who are too young to start participating in this master's degree, and they all want to get involved in some sort of project having to do with sustainability. And I'm sure after listening to everything you just said, the projects sound incredibly fun and diverse, and there's something for everybody. How would you recommend young people to start getting involved in this field before they get into the academic side of it?
Yeah, no, that's great. Well, I think there's a couple of paths. Definitely just go for a walk in the woods, right? Like get out and deeply immerse yourself in nature. Like become an observer of nature. Become one that doesn't just see nature from a distance, like a scientific eye or even just an aesthetic eye. But don't ask the question of what nature's doing, but how is it doing? And then with that how, and begin to try to unpack it, then build those connections back to your own world. How is that different than how I do things or might do things, right? And so there's a lens that you can develop as a young person or any age that helps you see nature differently. The second thing I would offer is go for breadth rather than depth. Right? So as you study in school, whether high school or college, have a wide variety of classes that you take, because the more you can understand the way the systems in the world work, the more you can actually intervene, right? Always ask those questions of both how do things work in humanity and how we're doing things, and how do other species do those things, right? So taking classes, you know, of course, in biology, but take some classes in design and engineering and business and sustainability and all of these things, and look for the bridges and the connections and demand those from your faculty, right? Demand that they not teach you something that they taught 5 years ago or 10 years ago or, God forbid, 25 years ago, right? Tell them that the world is changing faster than their curricula, and they owe it to you to at least help you tap into where that work goes. So yeah, staying broad, and then becoming a student of nature, and then asking those questions of not just what we're doing, but why are we doing this?
This was incredible. I'm sure everyone who's listening has learned so much and is incredibly inspired, and now will want to go out and take a walk in nature.
Excellent. Excellent. And then check us out at biomimicry.net. And then we got a bunch more resources. Our sister organization, the Biomimicry Institute, has a website called asknature.org. And you can type in questions. How does nature create color? How does nature filter water? How does nature cooperate? And find all sorts of really cool biology. There's also resources for teachers there. We just have an endless supply. At synapse.bio is where you'll find the mutualism webinar, as well as other webinars and postings. And
perfect.
Our work in the world is to try to get people informed.
Amazing. Well, thank you so much for your time today. I really appreciate it.
You're welcome. Happy to be here.
Thanks so much for listening. If you want to support this podcast, please visit sustainablepartnersinc.org/donate. Also, follow us on Instagram at sustainable.partners. Today's episode was engineered by Drew Alsbrook, produced and edited by Shelby Kaufman, and executive produced by Sustainable Partners, Inc. I'm your host, Adam Mett, and thanks for listening to Planet Reimagined.